number 4 in this series is Vietnam, yeah, and the U.S. As I interpret it, the topic basically has to do with the U.S. relationship with Vietnam, past, present, and particularly future, and the Cambodian peace process and the possible American role in this process. These are the subjects for discussion. We are to discuss what should be a U.S. policy with respect to having formal relations with Vietnam. I say formal relations, not normal relations. And we are to discuss what should be U.S. policy attitude toward the settlement of the Cambodian problem. Allow me to make a couple of basic points by way of setting the stage for the most efficient use of our time in discussing what is a fairly complex subject, actually two separate subjects. Point one has to do with the purpose of the discussion. To what end? That is, I think we can all agree, to determine foreign policies that serve our national interest. Agree as to what that national interest is, but not the national interest criteria. For the question is, what is the U.S. national interest with respect to relations with Vietnam and in regard to Cambodia? Two has to do with Cambodia. It asks the fundamental question, what can the U.S. do? We do, or what is it in our national to do, but what, and having established what actually is obtainable, we are willing to make the necessary commitment to bring peace and stability back to Canada. Three, we should not mix up these two issues. That is, the issue of relations with Vietnam and the issue of peace. They are separate issues that impinge on each other, but in fact, our role here, as I see it, is as referee or resource person, my favorite term, here to persuade or convince. I'm here to help supply the information you need. Good night. Lock up back there. Relations with Vietnam came the dust settling stage. Or so after the war, The U.S. was traumatized by events, and Washington was suffering from what I called the Carter administration, and was very small. Vietnam had an opportunity at that moment for diplomatic relations, away in what, in retrospect, can only be called a pure leadership blunder. President Carter, soon after taking office, dispatched the Woodcock mission to Hanoi to explore the idea of diplomatic recognition. Leaders took a very hardline approach. They spoke of American economic obligations. They mentioned the term war reparations appeared in the Hanoi press at the time the Woodcock explained the U.S. foreign aid process. The leaders he dealt with suggested that embassies be exchanged first. Then he said the new Vietnamese ambassador in Washington could begin soliciting economic. Hanoi stood by its quote precondition, aid before recognition. Now, in strict interpretation of international law, I should say, I owed the United States at least an apology for violating the agreements signed with the U.S. February 8th, the Paris Agreements. Now, these agreements, whatever else was their meaning, a concession of allowing Hanoi to keep 40,000 troops in someone else's. These agreements clearly stipulated no force augmentation, no troop increase by troop movement through Laos or through the DMZ. Virtually the entire North Vietnamese army was in South Vietnam at the end of the war, April 1975, and that represented, again, if not 1973, as part of the Paris Agreement's arrangements, in mid-1973, shortly after the Paris Agreements were signed, and as of the arrangements that were being made to implement these agreements, representatives from the U.S., that is from the U.S. Agency for International Development, AID, are represented from Washington. These representatives and representatives from Hanoi met in Paris for a series of technical level meetings. They discussed U.S. economic assistance to North Vietnam, to which the power clause. In the of these meetings, Hanoi presented the Americans with the proposed U.S. assisted reconstruction aid, a 20 price for which came to about 3.5. That's where the figure came from, which is bandied around a good deal ever since. In their document, the U.S. acknowledged the North Vietnam's economic need in it, although it did not state it outright. However, the second document also stressed two points. One, that the representatives in Paris did not have the authority to commit the U.S. to granting $3.25 billion, since this was that the U.S. too, that the U.S. considered any economic assistance for North Vietnam to be dependent on Hanoi's military restraint in the South. However, U.S.-Chinese relations were solidifying. This was the turning to China. Came to view the issue as a choice between Vietnam or China. No hard choice. Perhaps history will judge it was the wrong choice, but wrong it was the one made. Hanoi dropped its demand for reparations. We were not sure it was truly serious about establishing relations. With the a Treaty of Friendship and Cooperation with the USSR and the U.S. interests. this time, 1978, the Vietnamese invaded Cambodia, killing entirely the idea of establishing this concern. Came the present stage with the Reagan and then the Bush administration. It's a benign neglect. It is, in effect, a derivative policy. ASEAN and China will take the lead on this matter. This has something to recommend it, this approach. I have a holding operation than a policy. It automatically abrogates, by definition, abrogates American leadership, which means that so this policy, in Washington's view, is so derivative, derived from Hanoi's actions. Its intrusiveness into Cambodia, its intimacy with, so the policy say that the, to have diplomatic relations with Hanoi, and that it uses, it is that there are these issues which eggs as far as the microphone on this stupid thing. There it is, yes. The term normalization as applied to diplomacy is a slippery one, and it is best avoided if possible. The United States has, quote, normal relations with the Soviet Union, with Israel, with Canada, with South Africa, with Japan. But consider the enormous variety of sets of associations. There is hardly such a thing as a normal relation in world government. By the term properly used, is establishment of official government-to-government connections at some specific level. This can range from the lowly interest section to the fully staffed unit. Use it here. It means the States and the Socialist Republic of Vietnam would extend the level of diplomatic intercourse of the common among. Establishing a formal relationship would not mean new ambiance between us, or that either has changed. In the Thai refugee camps and along the Thai border. It is vastly overrated and is not to be taken seriously. It continues, that is the CGDK, continues to exist only by courtesy of China and the Thai generals. While it does have a certain amount of sabotage ability, can be a political spoiler, this will last only as long as outsiders continue to prop it up. If support is denied, Thailand seals the border, for instance, or the Chinese abandon their weapon shipments, the CGDK will dissolve, the war will fade, peace and stability will quickly return to Cambodia. So the basic irreversible fact is that control or sovereignty in Cambodia is firmly in the hands of the SOC. Now that is the first perception. It is the one held by the SOC itself, of course. It is also held by Hanoi, the USSR, and by a number of observers in the United States and elsewhere, some of whom are left-wing observers and some who are simply practitioners of realpolitik politics who say that whatever the merits of the case are, the fact is the SOC runs the country now and we might as well bow to the inevitable. Standing opposite this situation irreversible perception is a second perception. It has these characteristics. First and foremost, it holds that there is little government at all of any sort in Cambodia. In truth, no one is in charge. In brief, control is exercised by everyone and by no one. The SOC claims to the contrary are absurd pretense. It may control the capital, Phnom Penh, but even that is a very shaky
uncertain condition. Witness the recently imposed dusk to dawn curfew in the Capitol. Witness the bombings that go on there. Witness also the recent capture of Paulin, a rural town, by the DK, and the capture of a so-called liberated area by Son Son forces. Witness what we are really beginning to see in Cambodia, and that is the beginning of enclave government, little governments throughout the country. So what this amounts to, really, in essence, this perception continues, is anarchy. Anarchy in the kind of standard dictionary definition of the word, which is absence of government. There is no government in Cambodia of significance, according to this perception, particularly at the village level, where 85% of the people live. If the SOC were a government, it would have presence throughout the country, even if it were a challenged presence, but it does not. It does not have a military or security units stationed throughout the country. More fundamentally, it does not have the administrative presence, so it can't do the things that governments do: run hospitals and clinics, operate schools, build roads, canals, all those public services common to the government. Now, it cannot do those things because it does not have the personnel, the bureaucrats, the civil servants, the cadres on the scene, in the villages and at the district level to perform these services. Equally pretentious and absurd, this perception continues, is the SOC's claim that it has the loyalty of the Khmer people. In truth, the SOC leaders are seen by the people as country-selling lackeys, running dogs of the Vietnamese, who installed them in power with bayonets and tanks. The SOC is illegitimate in the worst or the greatest sense. It has sold its birthright by becoming collaborationist. Outsiders should recognize, as this perception continues, outsiders should recognize the SOC regime for what it is and what it then means in broader international context. The SOC was installed by an invading army using sheer military force. One country came into another in full-scale warfare, fought and replaced the government. There's no dispute about that fact. To endorse this action, even to acknowledge it legally, has profound meaning for international law and international relations. For years, right-thinking people and governments around the world have worked to establish the principle of integrity of self-determination, that no country can claim the right, the legitimate right, to overthrow another country's government and install one of its own choosing. To accept the SOC, then, is to help establish precedents. If in Cambodia, then why not in the Mideast? Why not in Central America? What was wrong with the Soviet action in Afghanistan? Now, to this second perception is appended a differing view of the CGDK. It says that admittedly the CGDK does not have great military strength and probably will never be able to install itself through military powers. Even to attempt so will probably bring back in the Vietnamese army, as has now happened anyway. There are now, as of last week, about 5,000 Vietnamese troops that had left last year are now back in Cambodia. But this perception continues. The CGDK does have strength. It has political strength, diplomatic strength, psychological strength, and moral strength. It is seen as legitimate by the Khmer people in a way that the SOC can never be seen. More importantly, the CGDK has captured the banners of Khmer nationalism. We all know what an enormous force for change and power is nationalism in Asia. Has been since the days that it drove out colonialism. Hanoi's most serious mistake in occupying Cambodia 9 years ago was not to allow the PRK, as it was then called, now the SOC, to pick up the banners of nationalism and become an authentic Khmer nationalist entity. Instead, the Vietnamese ran the country through the mechanism of a military government. Only much later, when they saw the wisdom of divesting themselves from their Cambodian problem, did they make the move to try to pass the burden of government and defense to Khmerize the war back to the SOC as nationalists. But by then it was too late. So the resistance, CGDK, whatever else, has captured the banner of nationalism. And for that reason, and that reason alone, it can command each year overwhelming, resounding votes of endorsement at the United Nations. It is for that reason, in this viewpoint, that while the CGDK may not win, it can never lose. Thus, this second perception does two things. It takes the high moral ground, standing against precedent for evil international behavior, and it makes the pragmatic policy argument holding that to back the SOC is to back, in the long run, a loser. These, then, are the two contending perceptions. If you take away nothing from this lecture but a clear realization that they exist and that they are themselves the problem, to a large extent, the time you spent here will have been well spent. The great debate that's been generated the last year and a half over the Cambodian peace process, including the Paris Foreign Ministers meeting last August, largely came down to people with differing perceptions talking past each other. Each speaker has his or her own mental picture of the Cambodian scene and proceeds to make policy recommendations, unable to understand while others, who have a different perception, are unable to grasp the obvious truth. It's very much like the poem The Blind Man and the Elephant. I don't know if you're familiar with this, Blind Man and the Elephant of Rajasthan. There were these blind men that were taken to see this elephant, and they subsequently discussed what an elephant is. And one of them felt the side of the elephant and said, "Why, the elephant is like a wall." And another picked up the tail and said, "Well, the elephant is like a rope." Another felt his leg and said, "The elephant is like a tree trunk." And this was a parody on religious beliefs of people arguing about what God is, and but I find it quite appropriate here. And so the last line ends, or the last stanza, "So oft in theologic wars the disputants I ween rail on in utter ignorance as to what an elephant means, and prate about an elephant that no one of them has seen." And I think the peace process in Cambodia fits this perspective exactly. People with different views arguing of what is necessary to bring peace, and they're going right past each other because they do not have a shared view as to what this elephant really looks like. Just very quickly, let me say a bit about historical perspective. Historians looking back at Cambodia note that usually conflict will arise all through history when one of three conditions develop. First, conflict is precipitated when outsiders see a threat to Cambodian sovereignty that endangers their interests, and then they intervene. The Thais intervene if they see the Vietnamese doing this, or the Siamese, as they were called before this, if the threat comes from Vietnam, or the Vietnamese if the threat comes from Thailand. Second, most common is when there is a disintegration of the Khmer ruling leadership elite. It's not a very big country, and it's a hierarchical one, so it is mandatory, really, if there is to be peace, that the small group of people at the top, not just the government, but the educators and the religious figures and so on, all have a general shared view as to what should be happening, what policy should be pursued in the country. The third most common cause of war and instability in Cambodia is when the leadership abandons its position of equidistance in foreign relations. It's a funny thing, but the historical, the foreign relations devices which other countries have used all through history, such as military alliances, balance of power politics, and so on, these have never worked well in Cambodia. Not sure why this is, but it is a historical fact. Therefore, the moral is that what the lesson to be learned is that if there is to be peace and stability in Cambodia, it requires three things. First, an absence of foreign military presence, not just the Vietnamese, but all foreign military presence. The second, a high degree of elite leadership unity, almost a kind of monolithic unity, which is certainly not the case if you look in your scorecard here. That's what that all is about, is how divided and disunited is the various contending Khmer elites. And third, a careful maintenance of equidistance or non-alignment in foreign policy. Those really should be the ultimate goals. Now, the peace process in Cambodia, I can tick off very quickly what is needed here. I guess I should do this. It's quite brief. We are in a hiatus now in terms of moving the peace process along. Nothing much has happened since the Paris conference last August. 18 foreign ministers were there. And it was an utter disaster, an utter failure. It accomplished nothing, and everyone went home, I think, particularly the foreign ministers, feeling that they'd been sold a bill of goods by being gotten there, partly by their own advisors, and were kind of determined not to get near this problem again for a while. So that's where we are. There's been a couple of meetings, one in Jakarta about last week, but did not accomplish anything either. So we're kind of in a hiatus. What still remains is what needs to be done, and I can tick these off very quickly in about a sentence each. There are six major things. First, there must be a ceasefire among all the contending Khmers, and you end the fighting, temporarily end the fighting. That's what a ceasefire is. Second, you must determine the nature of and the personnel for the future governance structure in Phnom Penh. How are these names that you find in these organizations on this chart to be reorganized or shaped into a single government with a single armed force? Third, you must sequester and disarm all of the contending Khmer troops. All of these elements you find listed here have their own armies and are in effect little governments. So the third thing that has to do, they must be sequestered, that is, sort of isolated, and then disarmed. That's the tough one. That's what the Vietnamese were trying to do for 10 years. Fourth, then there must be a recruitment and an installation of an external monitoring and peacekeeping force for Cambodia. Outsiders have got to come in and either monitor this process or actually keep the peace. And there, I can come back to that if you're interested in the details later. And the question is, who is this going to be? Is it to be the United Nations? Is it to be the Indians funded by the Japanese? Is it to be ASEAN? Who is going to do this? And there is no answer to that question. Five, then, must be the staging of free, fair, supervised elections, either to choose a new National Assembly or to elect delegates to a constituent assembly that will write a new constitution. And finally, there must be, this leads to the installation of a single new governing structure in Cambodia that's generally accepted to everyone. That's really the last act. Normally, in these scenarios, they will list also as number six, the holding of an international conference, which will legitimatize this process and will put some guarantees on the settlement arranged. That essentially is what needs to be done. if you can figure out a way to do it, I can guarantee you I will get you the Nobel Peace Prize. I've thought about it myself, because I'd like to get the Nobel Peace Prize. All right, now moving on to the second and somewhat separate subject of U.S.-Vietnamese relations. We do not have much of a relationship with Vietnam at the present time. There is a trade embargo, which is part of American legislation called Trading with the Enemy Act, which prohibits much economic exchange, and that is not possible until Congress changes the law. There's some room the Washington administration has in adjusting this, but not very much. We do have exchanges with them over various issues, the POW-MIA issue, divided families, emigre issues, emigration children, and that sort of thing. These are conducted either by people, American officials, who go to Hanoi or through the UN in New York. So there is a kind of relationship there now. It's simply very nominal. So what we're really talking about here is the term, what is commonly called in the press, a normalization of relations. I'm a former foreign service officer. Before I came to Cal 10 years ago, I was in the Foreign Service for 20 years, most of it in Vietnam. And so as a kind of ex-diplomat, I'm very chary of the word normalization as applied to diplomacy. It's a very, very slippery term. You know, the U.S. has normal relations with the Soviet Union, with Israel, with South Africa, with Canada, with Japan. These are all normal relations. You have to consider how vastly different they are. The truth is, there is no such a thing as normal relationship. And that's why I feel the word normalization is best avoided. What actually is meant here is the establishment of some official government-to-government connection at a specific level. It can be the lowly interest section, just a couple of people, or it can be the fully staffed embassy. It's most commonly defined as simply an exchange of embassies. We put an embassy in Hanoi, they put an embassy in Washington. These embassies then have the job of carrying on the traffic of diplomacy. I might say a word about defense diplomatic relations in general. As a general principle, I feel that it is better for a country to have a formal relationship with another country than not to have it. Simply because I think it's better to have people talk and listen even to one's adversary or potential adversary than not to do so. The problem is that diplomatic recognition is regarded as a political statement. Now, I can argue logically that diplomatic relations are merely facilitative. All they do is they do not approve or extend the mantle of legitimacy. They do not mean that bygones are to be fought. It does not mean that you like people or not. All you're doing is facilitating diplomatic intercourse. However, I realize that in the broader world, this view is not accepted. People see the recognition of a country as being conferring a sort of an honor or some kind of a legitimate behavior or action when. And if you believe that, and most of the world does, then there's not much I can do to talk you out of it. Nevertheless, I would still argue that there is no true political and just are involved in exchange of embassies. It doesn't mean that you like these people or you stop disliking them or anything, or they you, it's simply that you're having this exchange. Parenthetically, I would dismiss out of hand all the moral, ethical, and philosophic reasons for diplomatic recognition of Vietnam. First, because diplomatic relations follow only from perceived national interest on both sides, and not on some abstraction of sentiment. Second, because I do not feel that the United States owes Hanoi anything. We have no sins to atone for. We have incurred no debt of obligation as a result of our earlier presence there or our conduct during the war. A few Americans, I think, would argue that under no circumstances should we have diplomatic relations. Such a fact actually is irrational because it reflexively precludes serving our national interests, which could be served in some instances by having an embassy in Hanoi. The most important thing, I think, to make on this question of diplomatic recognition is, and this you may not suffer from this, but they do in some circles, very commonly in Washington, and that is to assume that great benefits will accrue to the U.S. in formal relationship with Vietnam. You hear the argument that out of it will come a diminution of Soviet influence in Indochina. Somehow having an American ambassador there will be able to reduce the amount of influence the Soviets have. It will cause the Vietnamese to behave more benignly in Cambodia. There will be great economic investment opportunities for American business, and so on. The implication is that this will all come about more or less automatically, beginning the day the American ambassador arrives in Hanoi. But the fact is that this will not happen. Diplomatic recognition is not a panacea for problem solving. All it is a means of exchanging information, making views known. There may be benefits come out of this, but these could come out just as easily, I would argue, without diplomatic recognition. So normalizing relations isn't going to have the effect that many people believe it does. It will give us some trouble, I think. Ours is a polycentric society, and there are lots of people in this country who do not believe that we should recognize Hanoi. Oddly enough, I'd say in Washington, in the Pentagon, there is a stronger sentiment for this than there is, say, in the State Department. The Pentagon, I think, tends to believe that somehow American presence in Hanoi will have some sort of a watering down effect of the Soviet-Vietnamese relationship. State Department people tend to see any move in this direction as being giving them trouble in their other bilateral relations with China, with the ASEAN states, and so on. Even though these other countries do have ambassadors in Hanoi, they do not feel that we should have them. Not exactly a logical position. Again, they would say if you had an ambassador, there would be no problem. But the act of establishing diplomatic relations will be a very dangerous signal and be a wrong precedent and so on. In the United States, I would say the strongest group opposing any kind of diplomatic recognition are emigre Vietnamese, or most of whom have lost their country, and they are very bitter about this in general, and they're bitter about any kind of move that they see as being designed to ameliorate this bitterness. Most Americans, I think, the public opinion polls show that most Americans are basically indifferent to this question. There's a small minority that are quite avidly in favor of it, another small group that's for it, and a small group that's quite militantly against it, the kind of Rambo crowd. But most Americans don't care one way or the other, and I think this is reflected in Congress, the representatives in Congress, where you have a few congressmen who are pushing for this quite hard, a few who are not, who are opposing it quite strongly, but the overwhelming majority of the congressmen are simply indifferent to it. Well, if you know anything about American politics, and particularly getting anything done in Washington, you know that if you have a policy on dead center, which is what is the condition now, that is, there is no no movement. There is a kind of slight nudge to change policy toward recognition and a kind of blocking action, mild thing, preventing it. But mostly this is a kind of countervailing forces, so it doesn't move at all. And if you, as I say, in Washington, to get anything done, you need to get everybody on one side pushing, and then you're lucky if anything happens. So given the fact that there is no great pressure for change, it does not seem to me that this is likely to happen in the near future. Now, to that, I would add then, I mean, this would perhaps bother me a little more if it weren't for the fact that my analysis of what's happening in Hanoi at the moment is that they are not interested in diplomatic recognition either. Now, they say they are, and because when people come and say, would you like to have a better relations with the United States, you can hardly expect them to say no. But the fact is that they are caught up in a political struggle in Hanoi, a very complicated generational transfer of power, a reformer, conservative struggle, and so on. And the fact of U.S. Relations is a pretty small matter in the scheme of things in Hanoi. What really counts there is the economy, which is in terrible shape. What do you do about it? With the war in Cambodia, or the problem in Cambodia, problem with the Chinese, overly intimate relations with the Soviets. Those are the big problems in Hanoi. Relations with the U.S., you know, let's not kid ourselves, is not all that important a matter to them. So I think their thinking at the moment is simply to let that matter lie as much as possible. They don't see that they're going to get any great benefits out of it at the present time either. So given that condition, where there's not much interest in Washington and not much interest in Hanoi, and no great arguments, no persuading, overriding arguments that can be generated as to why this should change, then it becomes Newton's second law of physics. Bodies at rest continue to remain at rest. Bodies in motion continue to remain in motion. But this is a body that is at rest, and it will continue to rest unless there's considerable impetus that gets behind it. All right, well, that's sort of once over lightly. Wasn't quite too sure what exactly how we'd proceed after this lecture, whether we want to deal with questions, or if people want to get up and make speeches, or whatever. Anyway, I thank you very much for your attention.
We have about 40 minutes left, and I want to call me about 50 minutes left. And
now we're old and brave, Fernando. Since many years, I haven't seen a rifle in your hand. Can you hear the drums, Fernando? Do you still recall the fateful night we crossed the Rio Grande? I can see it in your eyes, how proud you were to fight for freedom in